Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass. Today, I sit down with Daniel Brennan, owner and winemaker at Decibel Wines in New Zealand. He prides himself on producing wines using classic practices, minimal intervention, a community-based attitude. Combining the classic practices with modern in the vineyard and the winery, Daniel not only is inspired to make great wine, but to preserve our great planet. His fruit comes from Hawke's Bay and Martinborough, but it is beginning to make a name for himself right here in the United States. Today, he shares his story of how a Philly boy who grew up in the restaurant world went from a political and philosophy education to being a band manager and ultimately ending up halfway around the world making wine. While you are listening, if you could please rate and review and subscribe to the podcast so that Exploring the Wine Glass is seen more in the iTunes algorithm, I would greatly appreciate it. Enjoy the conversation. Sláinte. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Exploring the Wine Glass, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I'm your host, Lori, a UC Davis winemaking and WSET Level 2 graduate. Today on Allure of the Pour, I am sitting down with Daniel Brennan of Decibel Wine. So uncork, unscrew, or savor a bottle of your favorite wine and enjoy the conversation. So, hey, Daniel, how you doing?
Hello, I'm cold. I'm in Chicago.
You know, I would say I feel bad for you, but I'm in Jersey right now, and I think I might have you beat. It's 20 degrees here, and we have a pretty big wind chill this time. But
well, I think the only reason why I feel like I got you beat is because I should be in New Zealand in the middle of summer right now, and I'm sitting here freezing.
That I will give you. And that is one of the biggest reasons, actually, that I have yet to visit New Zealand is because the only time I can go is in your winter. And I'm sorry.
Still gorgeous.
But I don't want to be. I want to be there when it's summer, and I want to be outside enjoying everything, and I want to be there for like at least 2 weeks. So
at least.
Give yourself three.
Yeah.
All right.
For sure.
All right. You know, once I'm retired, I can do whatever I want. But I also may hit you up at that point get some work out of me. I would love to do a hard
sure.
something. And
we always like some strong backs, you know, so keen minds, you know, we're happy to put you to work. You'll work for wine, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I do now, right?
So. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. So we met at the Decibel Wine Dinner at Kitchen 330. And honestly, the wines were spectacular. In all honesty, I had never heard of Decibel Wines beforehand. And I am a fan, so you won me over very, very quickly with your wines. So.
Oh, it's not a, you know, I won't give myself too much credit on that because I think, the only credit I give myself is that I got a little bit lucky and moved into such a great wine region of Hawke's Bay, and then I think we did the Martinborough Pinot that night as well, but that's actually why I moved to New Zealand. But it seems that the world's palate is sort of falling in line with that little more cool climate, more acid-driven wines at the right time. So I think the whole audience, it's been received well, particularly in the last few years. Things are starting to build momentum. So, but not surprised you didn't hear about it before. You know, we're trying to make some noise now, you know.
Yeah, it's tough to get your name out there. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans drink American, you know, and so it
a little difficult to get your name out there when you're, you know, however, how many miles is that?
It's far. It's the other side of the world. Just know that. It's as far as it could be, probably.
It is a very, very long flight.
Yeah, and, you know, again, we're picking up some momentum, and I don't just mean decibel. I mean some of these alternate regions of New Zealand are really picking up steam now because certainly Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc paved the way, and I don't think it's going to go anywhere, and it's always going to be that point of reference for people that, you know, I had that moment in, you know, my 20s. I was like, oh, my gosh, what is this stuff? And it was, and you know it when you smell it, you know Marlboro Sauvignon Blanc, and it's like its own thing in the world of wine. Nowadays, I think those other wines from Hawke's Bay and Central Otago, so they started coming in right after, but there was a pushback because they were pretty expensive and nobody could get their head around it. But it's been not a bad thing because in those sort of 10 or 15 years, the quality from these other regions has just gotten better and better and better, and we found ourselves a lot more in what we should be making and the kind of styles. We've probably all pulled back on things like too much new oak and things like that. So, yeah, for a lot of reasons, it seems like it's the right time for all these great other appellations and regions of New Zealand.
Awesome. So let's get a little bit information about you. So you grew up actually in Philly. And your parents owned a gastropub. So you've been around food, and I'm guessing they had wine there, at least beer, at the place. So is this where you got your interest into the field?
Yeah. You know, I joke around it was a gastropub before the term existed, you know. But it had been a beer and shop bar as a kid, you know. Like you went in there at 9 in the morning and it was packed. It was an old ironworkers bar. And then in the early 90s, my father and mother bought it from my dad's uncle. And they kind of expanded on the row home that was next to it. So it's basically two row homes. And it's the type of place that you'll see the same people there 4 or 5 nights a week. And it was definitely instrumental in developing my palate. And because of I was in proximity to, at the time, the wine school, Philadelphia was only like 3 blocks away. I was starting to do the WSET thing and really getting into wines. But even before that, I mean, honestly, since I was a teenager, I was always probably grabbing bad wine, but I was always the guy grabbing, you know, bottles of wine and trying to go on a cheeky underage date somewhere in South Philadelphia at a BYO or something. So, and, you know, learn by cutting my teeth, sometimes literally with some horrendous wine. But, yeah, certainly the restaurant was the big step. And when I came back to it after working with I worked in the music industry for a bit in my early 20s after I finished university. And that time in my sort of late 20s, early 30s, and I think I jumped at the right time. I left the U.S. when I was 31. Any later than that, maybe too risky. I know I've talked to a lot of friends. And also the age sort of limitations and, you know, with New Zealand visas and all that. So it kind of all worked out to be a good time to go, you know, start, a second career or another, hopefully 3/4 of my life. But, you know, who knows what my life expectancy is.
At any point, were you interested in the food aspect of it, or was it always the wine?
I still cook all the time, but I don't want to. I never had any aspirations to be a chef, but I worked in the kitchen a lot. I worked, you know, mostly as a dishwasher, but occasionally on the cold side, and certainly, you know, would have been accused of going into the kitchen after midnight and, you know, making something. I never worked sauté. You know, that was the chef's job, but always had my head in the kitchen window and talking to the chefs and always cooking on my own and experimenting. So, yeah, I have a real real passion for food as well, and I like to experiment. The one thing that's been cool living in New Zealand is a lot more Asian dishes than I've ever worked with, a lot of different spices and things. So I say work with, I'm just cooking at home. But, you know, like I like to be a little adventurous, and I definitely, you know, we have a lot of fresh food in New Zealand, but particularly in Hawke's Bay. And, you know, my wife's from Italy, so we just cook all the time. She cooks, she's got her recipes, I've got mine, and we always cook a lot and cook fresh, you know.
And you went to college at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., and it was for politics and philosophy. So That's a big difference. What was going through your mind of what your career was going to be with politics and philosophy?
Well, you know, like most people, I came in basically undecided. I think I started a business or something and immediately decided I didn't want to do that. And then I had an open credit, and I just took like an American government class or something that fit into the schedule. And I don't actually like the American part of it, like the, you know, the American government stuff and American politics wasn't as interesting to me as the international stuff. And anyway, I was hooked, and I really liked the political philosophy part of it too, but I was like, philosophy minor, political philosophy major, like really no jobs are going to be available for me. So, but I kind of figured at a young age, I was like, I'm paying for this. I'm probably going to be in debt for a while with it. I know I could do other work and do jobs, and I couldn't really get my head around, like, I'm going to study something that I'm going to work in for the rest of my life. So I just figured I want to study something I was interested in. And it was lucky because then I got to go live in Belgium and work in the European Parliament. And you know, so a lot of that stuff, believe it or not, nowadays has helped in the wine industry, you know, because I've lived, you know, I got to live in Europe. Now we have a distributor in D.C. I get to have some experience there, you know, so it all worked out. And sometimes you need to be very philosophical in the wine industry, you know.
I'll give you that.
Especially when payday comes around and you don't have any money left for yourself, you know.
Yes, I get that. So you mentioned about working in Parliament. I don't know. That sounds pretty darn impressive to me. I mean.
It was no more than being like an intern and on the Hill or something like that. Like trust me, when I got the job and I was there and I like showed up, I was and the responsibilities that were given to me, I was like, whoa, I'm so lucky and I'm definitely not qualified. But you know, you just sort of fake it till you make it. And I worked for a British Parliament member. I mean, we were given the jobs as part of the study, as me and two other guys who were doing the program, and they were more finance guys. I was, you know, way more into the politics and the history, European history, and this is pre-Euro as well, so all this stuff that's going on now with Brexit, and I hate to say it, but we were all asking the question back then as Americans, like, you guys sure you want to do it this way?
Oh, see, they should have listened to the interns.
I guess, yeah. Well, no, but it was, you know, it was very evident at that time, working for a British Parliament member who was a Labour Party member and was fairly liberal, that the UK had always kept it at arm's distance. They kind of had their position that we're not exactly part of this, but we are close players involved. They kind of had their own, you know, and they weren't going to do the euro. It was like never on the table. Why would they? They had the British pound. It was like the strongest currency in the world at the time. So, but anyway, you know, you fast forward, I'm not as surprised probably as some other people, that's all.
Now, what happened that made you say, politics and me, no, I'm going a different route?
That job was a big part of it. It was really bureaucratic, really, you know, you can only imagine things are in 7 or 8 different languages, and there's so much red tape you can't imagine. And it wasn't as interesting as me, you know, as a day-to-day job. And I continued to, like, again, I loved, like, political philosophy and reading, you know, Nietzsche and Camus and all that stuff. But as far as a day-to-day job, it's just, you know, I'm not going to wear a tie every day. That's not me, you know what I mean?
So you left politics and you went to become a band manager. So far,
sounds crazy when you have to say it like this.
You're not even on a spectrum because you're over here, then woo, you're over there, and then you're over there. So, like, band manager, cool job, not a cool job, like, you know.
A very cool job, very fun.
Awesome job.
It was almost the exact opposite of you know, those were right back to back to each other. But, you know, I finished school and worked for a little bit. But I was always helping these guys out. There was a guy I grew up with who moved to New York when we were kids. And then he put out a CD, and it was awesome. And all my friends got into it. And I threw, which, you know, this does translate to nowadays. We lived in a house in Washington, D.C., in Northeast D.C., which was a pretty tough neighborhood, and we threw a 50, and this is not a fraternity or anything, it's just like some friends together. There were no fraternities at the school. We threw a 50 kegs of beer we had in our backyard, and we had three live bands, and the band that was my friends, they were like, after we did it the second year in a row, they were like, why don't you just do this for us all the time? And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. And I took a little time to think about it. And then, in 2000, basically the beginning of spring of 2000, I think it was, I went on with them full time and never looked back until they were a bit older than me. So they started having kids and getting married and all that. That didn't necessarily line up with the road anymore. So, I went back to start working more at the restaurant, but it was a great experience. I mean, even now I was in Chicago, I was in Atlanta last week, for a distributor meeting, and I saw this place. I went, oh my gosh, that's Smith's old bar. And it was, I'll never forget those stairs, because it was these iron, black iron stairs that went up the back of the building. We had to carry all our gear up there. And I was like, oh, that's a nightmare gig. But, you know, it was like pretty good. It was, you know, it was fun gig, but like the worst load in and load out of anything. But, it's basically what I did from, you know, probably 22 to 27, 28 or something like that. And, It was a ride, that's for sure. They were called, mostly with the one band, Seeking Homer, but I helped out a couple bands in Philly and stuff too, yeah. But they were out of the Bronx, so I spent a lot of time in New York. The drummer was from a real rough neighborhood, and but they had two good-looking white boys up front singing who went to Fordham and then kind of matched with the two guys, you know, for the more neighborhood guys. And it was a really good dynamic they all had. And everybody's still friends. And it was good. But they used to play the Wetlands in New York all the time. They had a live double disc from the Wetlands. That was like their sort of crowning achievement, in my opinion. You know.
I have two friends that one, my next door neighbor, who we joke, I used to play wiffle ball over our fence back and forth. He started with the Misfits and is part of Danzig. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Danzig, serious.
Irivon. So they all went to Glenn Danzig and Irivon went to my high school. They were, Irivon, it's like I had to get used to calling him that because that's not his name. He's my brother's best friend growing up. You know, I mean, he lived next door to us. And then Glenn was at our high school too. And so we have that. And then, you know, the Misfits are all from our area. So that.
Yeah. Classic band, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because every time I hear, well, actually, they hate it. It's like you can't say mother to them.
Yeah.
Hate the fact that that's all anybody ever wants to hear or talk about. But every time I hear it, it just cracks me up that, you know, that's my friend, you know.
Yeah, I know, it's hilarious. That was a big hit too.
Yeah, and then in college. I had a very good friend that was a drummer, and he used to do all of those types of gigs where you're literally lugging everything up all over. But one club, we got to meet Guns N' Roses. They were
nice.
There. So, like, I was sitting drinking with Axl, you know?
So were they like, on their way up, or were they already?
Yeah, they weren't.
And...
Nobody knew who they were yet. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard stories about Guns N' Roses on their way up that, like, they were just absolute fire. Like, you know, everybody was like, who the hell are these guys, you know? But they kind of sat around. You know, that album was out for, like, a year, year and a half before it broke. For whatever reason, yeah.
Yeah, because
Axl.
It was popular when I was in college. I think my junior year was Welcome to the Jungle.
Oh.
So, I'm old. But I agree. I think the music was already out there, or the album was already out there, but whatever it was, it just took a while to do it. But That was fun to sit there.
Well, Lori, I got to say, I didn't know we were going to be talking about Guns N' Roses and Danzig when we started this podcast. Okay.
I told Jay that it can go whatever direction it needs to go in.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but that was some fun times. That was fun times. But now I'm going to put you on the spot to what is your favorite type of music?
I wish there was a word that I could try to just describe it, but it's probably that sort of mid-range, what's the word I like to call it, you know, more to incendiary guitar, probably those bands like Peter Gabriel, The Police, U2, that's kind of my real era, my sweet spot, REM, that sort of sweet spot, you know. Grunge was probably my age, but I don't identify quite as much, and I saw a lot of jam bands back in the day, but the, you know, as far as music that I feel like was mine when I was, you know, like I hear an old Police song and I'm like, yeah, that's my stuff. And I absolutely love Peter Gabriel. At one time, you know, it was U2, but, you know, obviously they just keep going, putting out stuff. I don't even know. I'm lost in the shuffle, but they'll always have albums that I absolutely adore. Same with REM. But yeah, that's that kind of sweet spot. And the band that I worked with kind of sounded like that. There was some bands like The Samples out of Colorado that I really loved. And that's pretty the sweet spot. You know, I have family history with, like, the Allman Brothers and all that kind of more jazz rock type of stuff. But, yeah, that sweet spot for me and sort of coming of age, you know, you never I don't think you can ever get past, if you're a big music fan, the music that really hit you when you were coming of age, you know. Sort of for me it was, like, 10, 11 years old all the way into my – teenage years, even Jeff Buckley to an extent, you know, was around that time. Again, loved a lot of the grunge music and that kind of stuff when I was in high school, but the stuff that I really go back to and still listen to and still have, like, a lot of feeling with is that stuff, yeah. So I don't know, what do you call that, you know, sort of progressive...
progressive rock?
Yeah, it's definitely not prog rock. I'm not, like, into Yes and ELO. Okay. And, yeah, that kind of stuff, that proggy, more prog stuff. I mean, I don't mind it, but that's not my thing. Yeah, sort of, I don't know, what do we call that?
I don't know. I did love the Police. I have to say that.
Yeah, they're awesome.
I had a lot of Police stuff up in the room and that.
Good-looking guys, too, right?
Yeah, Sting wasn't too bad. Sting wasn't too bad. You know, even Andy Summers, See, I still can recall their names. Like,
yeah. Stuart Copeland.
Yep.
Yeah, and they you can go deep with, like, I had a young friend who's another winemaker, this guy Bryce Edmonds, who makes some really good wines called Zaria. They're just sold domestically in New Zealand. He's a big music fan. We always talk about music. And I had, like, a deep track from the Police come on, and he was like, who's this? And, you know, he's a bit younger than me, and I'm like, who do you think it is? Wait to hear the voice. And he's like, is that Sting? And I'm like, yeah. He just knew kind of Sting. He didn't really, and he knew the hits. And I was like, no, man, you got to go deep. These guys are serious, serious musicians. And he's like a huge Police fan now, you know, way, way after the fact. He had no idea of all the amazing jazz and punk and reggae that they were doing. So, no, they're great.
Synchronicity too, that whole, good stuff. Good stuff. But as much as I like the Police, I'm really kind of, if I've got to classify myself, I'm kind of a metalhead.
Yeah, I could tell.
Metallica owns a lot of my money. Well, Messiah. Look,
well,
you're
the
only person who knew who I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, you don't have to do much, you know, connecting the dots, and I'm like, in a bar with Axl Rose, like, what kind of bar was that? What kind of music was on in the bar? Like, I get it. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Awesome.
All right, so we'll wrangle it back to wine, because I really could talk about music for a long time. But so before we started recording, we were talking about you traveling, and everybody who knows I'm bi-coastal always like, oh my God, it must be so nice. You travel back and forth all the time. And I'm like, yes, until you're on the plane and dealing with all of that stuff. As much as it sounds amazing, like, it's not. So what do you like about traveling? New Zealand to America is a long flight. So what do you like about it? What don't you like about it?
I mean, I miss my family. That's number one. And I get, I get a little, of course you can get lonely. I just try to stay as busy as I can. And like today, I was in Chicago a day early, met up with an old friend, we caught up for a little bit and just try to fill the time. A lot of times that can be pretty easy because there's so much other work to do and email and blah, blah, blah. But that part I don't like, and I really like, our life in New Zealand, and we're very lucky and fortunate that we live, particularly my daughter gets to live this life where she can run around in vineyards and around our property and in town. It's very, New Zealand's very safe. It's very, very nice place to live. And so I miss that, and I miss our life like that and, simple day to day. But at the same time, I know you got to go out and nobody's going to sell your wine for you. You got to get out there and do it. So, we did a lot of traveling over the years, and I have a gift of being able to sleep kind of anywhere, anytime. I'm a light sleeper generally. Like, I don't need to set an alarm to get up, but I also can crash on a plane if I need to, or nod off, take a nap in the afternoon. I meditate. That's unbelievably huge to, I have to do it. It's something I didn't know I needed to do until I started traveling a lot for work about 4 or 5 years ago. I was talking to a friend about it, and they were like, you don't think about it in your head, but kind of what you have is anxiety. I was like, oh, really? Is that what that is? that thing is building up in there. So I'm not immune to it, and I know people can get certainly more stressed out than I can, I don't necessarily have like a bad temper or anything, but I know people can get stressed out from travel. And that's, in the last probably 3 or 4 years, been probably the biggest difference, is being able to like center, calm down. If you have 20 minutes to just go away, go somewhere quiet, and try to take care of yourself the best you can. And then it can be really enjoyable, and then you can, get work done, you can be positive, maybe it'll run out someday, but I still walk into any wine shop, and I'm happy to walk around for, 10 or 15 minutes and just, oh, that's interesting that these guys are selling, and just kind of fill the hard drive with what I see trends are and what's going on. And I know some people just aren't as interested and don't care, but I could walk into a gas station wine shop and just walk around. I'm like, oh, look at that. Look what they got there, And I mean, it might be 1 minute in that place, but at least I still have a real driving curiosity. And I think when you're this little tiny, tiny wine region and make a very little bit of wine, it's really humbling and educational to go out and travel. They say, travel's a pacifying force. It's absolutely true. Like, I'm in Chicago. This place is amazing. It's gigantic, and nobody's ever heard of me here. So it's like, yeah, you better, get off your stoop and get selling,
Okay. So how do we go from a Philly boy to New Zealand?
Well, I mentioned before I was doing like WSET and doing these like core courses this guy had at this wine school in Philadelphia. And there's been a couple other winemakers there's a girl named Jenny Schultz who works out in California now. She's really getting to be a pretty well-known winemaker as well. And I think there's one other guy, but I don't know who he is. Our interest got piqued, or my interest got piqued, and then I pulled him aside and I said, like, hey, man, like, I want to get out of the restaurant. I want to do this. How do I do this? And he was like, start studying chemistry, buddy. And I was like, okay. So I did. I had a buddy who was doing, like, his MCATs, and he was giving me his MCAT books and his chemistry books. And I was quietly going to this diner called Sabrina's around the corner from my family's restaurant. And, people kind of knew me in there because they know the bar or the restaurant or whatever, and they were like, they just couldn't figure out what I was doing with these giant books in there. And I just started looking for schools, and right away Davis was like way too expensive and was just not an option. And I kind of I never really drank a lot of California wine. It was only later in my 20s when I started having older friends who would come into the bar who had money, and they were like, check this out, you know, and I was like, oh, this stuff's really good. So I didn't have like a big connection with California. Later on, I went and did some vintages there and stuff, but I knew I wanted to go somewhere cool climate. I knew I wanted to go somewhere up and coming. I couldn't go somewhere where you had to learn, you know, study chemistry and Spanish. I couldn't, there's a Japanese winemaker in New Zealand called Kasuda. He taught himself German and went to wine school in Germany. I was like, I'm not going to do that. I don't have the time or money to do that, or probably the brain, but I did study German a long time ago. But so it kind of narrowed it down, and I had my last two choices were Walla Walla, Washington, which is a really good school up there, and this school I found in Hawke's Bay because it was near – close enough to Martinborough. I just looked on the map and I went, never had a wine from Hawke's Bay before. I met one New Zealand guy who was, all he said to me was, oh yeah, Hawke's Bay, best weather in the country. And I went, that's a positive. And so I went sight unseen, never tasted a wine, went by myself. You know, I had a little bit of money saved up, but not a lot. In fact, definitely not a lot by the end of the first year. Thank God, you know, there was the New Zealand dollar crashed when the global financial crisis hit, and I put all my money into New Zealand and paid the rest of my tuition. But it was really a leap of faith, and I really went all in, and I definitely had some oh shit moments when I first got there. I don't know if I can say that on there, but I had moments like that, a lot of them in the first 6 months. And the first one was when I flew into Auckland, and I took the bus down to Hawke's Bay. And, you know, the scenery was pretty nice and all that, but when we pulled into Napier and I saw how really small it was, you know, this was the city that I thought I was moving to, and I just went, oh, okay, like, wow, my world just got really small. And then, you know, there was a lot of that. But then I liked the wines right away, so that was great. Like, the first weekend I was there, it was a big wine festival at all the wineries, and I was like, this Sauvignon Blanc's really different. And I thought right away, I thought, oh, this would be good in America. And it just started building. That curiosity kind of came right away, thank God. And, you know, I don't know. I guess I was dumb enough to keep trying. And I met my mentor within like a month of being there. I kind of scoped out what winery I wanted to work at. And I went to work for this winery called Tiawa, which at the time was privately owned, but now it's owned by Villa Maria, a bigger winery. So I was working. I purposely went to work there because they were my favorite wines in the region. And when I started working there, the winemaker was out of town on a, you know, sales trip, kind of like I am now. And she came back, and I was working behind the bar for a wedding, and she came back with all these bottles of wine. I was like, can I help you? Like, what are you doing behind my bar, you know? Like, I didn't say exactly like that, but she was like, no, I'm pretty good. Like, don't worry about it. And then the next day I went up to her, I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. You know, she's like, I had a feeling like you didn't know who the hell I was, you know, and we're like really great friends to this day. And she's a huge influence and still helps me with my wines. And she's an amazing person. Her name's Sandy Dobson, and just so giving and knowledgeable. And if it wasn't for certain people like that, like, I don't know what would have happened, but she was probably top of the list of somebody who just fed me and kept, you know, she saw how crazy passionate I was and nuts I was. And I was like, first of all, just being there in the first place.
Right.
And she helped, you know, fuel the fire and always, you know, help me find work and things like that, you know. So, it was a bit of a ride those first few years, you know.
So how long were you in the wine industry before you took the next leap of faith to start your own label?
1 year.
Wow.
But I mean, it wasn't, you know, people think like, oh, you just get started. And I try to explain this to friends now who, I like to think of myself as part of this group of friends and winemakers in Hawke's Bay, and there's some in Martinborough too. Like, we didn't come at it with a lot of money. We didn't come at it with, like, we were chief winemaker for some giant winery and then split off on our own. We're working up from the very, very bottom of cellar hands and, you know, starting with one little barrel and one little and then slowly making more and more wines this year. And what I try to tell friends, like, yeah, I made some Sauvignon Blanc and Malbec, but I made, like, I think it was 2 barrels of Malbec in 2009 and 250 cases of Sauvignon Blanc. And, you know, it was all a punt, and luckily I knew some people in Philly, but it was probably about 2011 before the wines got there or anything, and it all came to fruition. So it wasn't really the first year. And the other thing that I have to remind some of my friends is, like, I didn't make any Sauvignon Blanc in 2010. I didn't make any in 2012. I didn't make any Malbec in 2012 or 13. Like, I had to skip vintages and, you know, run stock down. It wasn't like I just was all of a sudden up and running. It seems like that to people, but it wasn't like that at all. And, you know, I have friends who get, like, frustrated because they're like, oh, man, I had this fruit and I lost. And I'm like, man, it took me, like, 10 years to, like, have enough reputation with these great growers to know they're going to get paid and I'm going to take this block and I've earned it. And I sat in line for 2 years waiting for this fruit. And so it's, it wasn't 1 year. I mean, it was 1 year, but it was, I started making wine right away because I was in school and, you know, we got given fruit and stuff. But, yeah, the next year I bought some fruit and I was like, well, let's just try it, you know.
I had a lot of help. That's something that I try to explain to people. They're like, well, how come you're still here, like in Jersey? Like, how come you're not doing the wine full time? Because, you know, you can't just jump in and, you know, you can't start making 10,000 cases when nobody knows who you are. We're thrilled. We started at like 100 cases and we're just at about 400 in 4 years. But having full-time jobs is what's paying for that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the other thing. I was working for other people this up until only 2 years ago. So it was 10 years, you know, it was basically, okay. Well, it was 9 years of working for other people. And then I've only just split off a couple years ago, or okay. 3 years ago. So it takes time. And, you know, there's a lot of factors in there. And there's no perfect one way to do it. And especially you guys are trying to, you know, you're trying to plant things now and it's just a long process, you know? So, I get it, you know?
We're thrilled with that, you know, increase. People don't get it, but we're thrilled. And, you know, like you said, those growers, they want their money and it's a long, you know, you're not seeing any results for 2 years or 2.5 years when you're starting, you know, but I honestly would.
Joke around, you know, people go, you know, I don't go on too many wine tours or go to winery. I just went to Alto Adige, which was just amazing, and the mountains, the Dolomites and all that. That was crazy. They had some really interesting things there. But even like the old, we went to this really old monastery that was making wine for 1,000 years. There wasn't anything that they were doing in there that was crazy to me, you know, that was like, wow, look at that. It was just really cool and beautiful and old. But when I go to Method production and Champagne production, like we went to Berlucchi in Lombardia of like 4 years ago, that blows me away because I'm like, wait a minute. Your cheapest wine is 5 years before you even can release it, you know? And I'm like, you guys need a lot of money.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. And that's like Franciacorta, you know, with how long they – it's like when I started learning about Franciacorta, I was like, oh, my God. Like,
yeah, that's where we were. Yeah.
Yeah. How does that even play into your wallet, you know, at all? You know, I thought 2 years was bad. You know, and it's crazy. Now, you kind of mentioned a little bit about it. One of the things that we fell in love with in Paso when we first got there was the whole pay it forward concept in Paso. Winemakers help each other out. You know, we always can go to somebody and ask questions, and there's really no, I don't see any real competitiveness at all. Everybody seems to be willing to help us. And that's not exactly true in some other areas. But it seems that it is that way in New Zealand. You guys seem to help each other out?
Yeah, I think in most wine regions, It is. I think, I obviously can't speak, and there's, of course, there's assholes everywhere. Don't get me wrong. But the vineyard manager who kind of came from, I think he came from Orchards, who works on the vineyard where I get my Malbec from. When he first started there, he's like, I've never seen anything like this where you guys, because I would just come and borrow equipment and then I'd come and help out, do some other job. And he's like, it's really, really great to see. And it's why, and I do think, there is some competition. It's healthy competition, and there's literally competitions that you can enter your wine. But me and my friends, we're always competing and like, hey, check this one out. I made this one and this and that. But it's not like, I don't think if that guy's selling more wine than you, it's not necessarily, it's probably your fault. You know what I mean? It's not anything. They're squeezing you out of a market or something. And there's a lot of wine in the world, but there's always places to sell your wine as long as you don't make too much. But I think it's really hard for, and why probably it hasn't gotten bigger, like say on the East Coast. I know climate and humidity and all that is tough, but you might be able to find, and I know sort of places like this in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, the perfect hillside where it's, warm enough and the moisture doesn't come and it doesn't get frosted and all that. You can grow, a nice Merlot right there or something like that. But you need the critical mass of a wine region to really make great wine. And that's why, some of my friends in Hawke's Bay won't want to hear this, but we don't make a lot of great Pinot in Hawke's Bay. There's only a few people that do it. Maybe those sites could be good, but they really do it better south of us, not only because of the weather, because it's the only red they grow, and they are just, it's like, you compound the learning, because instead of two guys or one guy learning, 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 are, and then they're like, what's they're doing over there? I tasted that. Oh, that Cooperage, yeah, they're awesome. I'm going to try them next year. And then, it just goes so much faster. Oh, what's that piece of equipment at? What are you doing in your vineyard? What's under the vine there? Oh, you leaf pluck on the sun side only and not the – or morning side only. All these things just, bam, they add up so much quicker. And I've seen it happen, it live in New Zealand in the last 10 years in Hawke's Bay. There's such a huge learning curve, and things are happening so fast there because there's so many passionate, good producers, good growers, people selling wine all over the world with all different backgrounds. So they're bringing all these different things to the table. And I just think it's really hard to want to say, I'm going to try this on my own. You know, you could be a billionaire and your wine's probably going to stink. Because especially if you only taste your own wine all the time, you got to go out, taste your, it's great, yes, of course, to go to other wine regions, but you got to taste all your friends' wines. You got to, you really got to get out and make sure that you're not completely missing the point. We call it, the cellar palate.
Right.
You're like, yeah, this stuff's pretty good. I got a really good friend. And I don't know, he probably won't listen to this, but some other friends might, and they'll know who I'm talking about. He must have a blank spot for a little bit of VA and a little bit tastes like his barrels aren't topped quite enough and he's drinking out of them. And his wines are pretty good and the fruit's pretty good, but you're like, dude, you got your own cellar palate because you're drinking your own stuff too much.
Yeah, and that's exactly, I try to explain that to people. That's true. You lose recognizing something is off. If that's all you're drinking, it's like going nose deaf. You're sitting in a room that smells like bacon, and it smells awesome to start off with, and then 2 minutes in, it doesn't smell like bacon anymore.
It's like winemakers who smoke. I'm like, people say, oh, how can you be a winemaker and smoke? I'm like, well, their palate's just different. I've been lucky. I never got addicted to cigarettes or anything, but they just have a different palate. They probably like a little bit stronger oak, or maybe they like bigger tannin or whatever it is, but they're definitely part of the palate, that's for sure.
That is true.
And now, a word from our sponsor. Looking to be in the know about Dracena Wines? Want to know when we release our new wines? Find out about all of our accolades and get some behind-the-scenes information? Well, all you need to do is sign up for our newsletter. There is no commitment necessary, and I promise you we won't spam your mailbox with loads of messages. Need another reason to sign up? Quite possibly the best reason? You will immediately get a code for a special discount on all of our wines and be privy to newsletter-only specials. Let Dracena Wines turn your moments into great memories. Sign up simply by heading to our website, dracenawines.com, and fill out the pop-up or sidebar. It will take less than a minute of your time, but the rewards will last forever.
So tell me, I'm going on a limb here. Decibel is because of your wine because of your music background. That's where we came up with the name.
It's also my initials, Daniel Brennan, DB, Decibel. So it was kind of part of the music thing. They were kind of, they say, like sound techs would be having these little sound meters, and especially play outdoor gigs. They'd be like, can't be over 100 dBs, And so I used to advance the shows with the sound techs, and these guys are like, talk about crossover. They were like chefs, They were like, they could ruin your night completely if they were mad at you. So from the time we booked the gig, I was always trying to be nice to these guys. And just as a dumb little joke, I would put at the end of my emails, like, here's our stage plot, we'll be there at 5 o'clock, blah, blah, blah. And then I put, cheers, DB. I still put that in my emails now. And a buddy of mine, when I moved to New Zealand, he's like, you should put that on your label. And I was like, well, there's D. Bartolo and a few other, and there's DB Breweries, actually, a huge brewery who have known to have some horrendous litigation in New Zealand. But Decibel, I was like, I thought of that word, and I was like, that's a good word. It's a good, strong word. So I copyrighted it, and yeah, got a copyright now. So, and everywhere where we sell it, at least,
Right. And that's kind of interesting in its own right, because it's tough to come up with a name for a winery that's not already taken. And with how many musicians, although I guess that's kind of more recent, all of the musicians who are deciding to become wineries also. But to have, and I don't mean that it's a common name or a common word, but Decibel.
Oh, I know. I've had a lot of buddies over the last, particularly 5-6 years, so they'll be like, I think I've got a good name for a wine. I'm like, let's Google it. There's a winery in Timbuktu that's got one of those, that name. You sure you're not, do you really want to be competing against that in 5 years, but you're right. It's tough to come up with a name that you can identify. And sometimes even just your last name, I had the easy decision. Brennan is my last name. There's a Brennan Winery that's well established in Central Otago. They make great Pinot Noir. I met the guy finally a few years ago, and so that was easy. I'm not going to call my wine Brennan Wines. I probably wouldn't have liked the names. And then I got really weird. I do that other label called Junta. I don't know. Did you taste that? That's named after my grandmother. So I do a Malbec Nouveau and I do a Chenin in that range. And I always want
to. I did taste it and didn't realize it was a different label.
I can't remember if the Malbec Nouveau was at that wine dinner.
Yeah, it was. I believe it was.
Yeah. So that's under Junta, which, again, I got lucky. It's a weird spelling, so it's G-I-U-N-T-A. So I don't think anybody would have purposely chosen that name for a wine. But then I just trademarked another name for my reserve range called Testify. Nobody had it.
Wow.
And I got it in the U.S. and New Zealand and Australia and China and stuff. And, like, I don't know, nobody took it. And, we got a bunch of lawyers buying the wine now,
There you go. Awesome. Now, in the back of my head, there's a winery that has a blend that I thought was, but maybe, I guess not. But I guess that
maybe
would be.
Maybe they do. But we got the trademark.
Right. That's awesome. Yeah, we had a lot of difficulty because we knew it wanted to be after our dog, and the Weimaraner is known as a gray ghost. So we initially wanted gray ghost, and we were spelling it with an A, gray with an A. And there's a gray ghost in Virginia, a gray ghost winery in Virginia, and it's G-R-E-Y. And we thought that it would be okay because California versus Virginia, and ours is a dog, and his is about a spy from the Civil War. So we thought it would be okay, but I reached out to him because we didn't want to do the branding and all of that,
sure.
And then he cut off.
Due diligence.
he was like, nope, nope, I come after you. Nope, nope, nope. So we did that. And then our dog was named after a constellation. And we're like, we are not doing anything constellation, nothing.
Stay away from that.
Right. So that's where Dracaena came from, is because Draco, there's a tree, and it's called a Dracaena Draco. So that's where it comes from. But it takes a lot to come up with a name.
Yeah, to try to get one that nobody. I had buddies in New Zealand, and one guy, they didn't know each other, like, but now they're friends actually. He had Element Wines, and he called his wines Element, but never trademarked. And then he kind of stopped making wines for a little bit because he skipped a couple vintages. And then this other guy came in, like right around the corner, and it was only like barely a commercial venture. It was like, you know, I was making like a couple barrels of wine, and this guy and his wife, and they just independently thought about Element Wines. They, you know, never heard of it because the wines weren't out in the market or anything, and. It was like, you should have trademarked that, man. You know, like if somebody that close can walk away with it. It's really tough. I've seen a big Elephant Hill as a winery in Hawke's Bay had to pull a bunch of wines off the shelf because, again, they tried to use Element Series in the wines, and they were like, you didn't do your due diligence in the region, let alone the rest of the world. And they had to pull a bunch of shelf stuff. So it could be, yeah, you might as well just check it out and call the people up because it'll save you a lot of money down the road.
Yeah,
you know?
Because it's a lot more money once you get going and have to recall everything than to just come up with something new.
Yeah, and I learned a lot about from our trademark attorney, which, you know, it is called a trademark for a reason because you can own a trademark, but if you're not actually trading in the country that it's trademarked, you know, it's easy for somebody else to make an argument and say, oh, I've been trading since before they even had the trademark, and it can be, because there's actually a decibel champagne or something, or a sparkling wine, or it might be a cava or something, but it was only ever sold in Portugal for 1 year. And I think it's a champagne. And so they had I think their EU, I probably shouldn't even say this, but their EU expires, or the copyright expires, and they, you know, again, they're not trading in the market anymore. So, and that's why there was this huge email that just went out to all New Zealand wine growers recently. There was a company in China that like took almost, and thankfully Decibel's trademarked in China, but they took like, they went through every New Zealand brand and tried to trademark them. And the New Zealand Patent Office and talked to the Chinese government. They kind of sorted out most of them, but I saw the list, and there's still some of my friends on there. It's down to like 20 now.
Yeah,
it's scary stuff.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing, and they're doing it here in America too. They're just buying the trademarks, and there's really nothing you can do about it if you're, like you said, if you're not trading in China, there's not much you can do about it. It's scary.
China's a little weird. Their trademark office works a little different. I think it is like first to market and stuff too. So they actually had an argument because it was like this guy isn't, or group or whatever, doesn't actually have any of these wines. So they were easily able to wipe off a bunch of them and reject them. And I think China's trying to clean up their act. But,
Well, that would be nice. Okay, so on your website you have, I have taken the spirit of my great-grandfather, Miguel Rodolico, and his entire lineage with me. What do you mean by that?
Well, first of all, I just found out something in December. I sat down with a bunch of my mom's cousins, and I always assumed it was Miguel. I've never met my great-grandfather, because that's what we call my grandfather, and we jokingly call my Uncle Michael. But his name was actually Michelin, and I'm about to update and redo that whole section because there's a bunch of stuff I want to add to it. Michelino, but they called him Michelin. And he was a Sicilian immigrant. And honest to God, I didn't find this out until I knew my grandfather made, you know, wine in the basement in South Philly and stuff. There's a lot of old Italians that do that still. But I had no idea that my great-grandfather, until I was in New Zealand, my mother told me, she goes, you know, your great-grandfather made wine. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah, and he was actually a cooper. too, like a real cooper. He made his own barrels and everything. And I said, really? I was like, wow, this is really cool. And like, so all of a sudden, I felt this connection to him. And it was pretty cool that, or at least I thought, it was really neat that I ended up doing this sort of independent of having known anything about that. It was like he moved, you know, he was a winemaker cooper in Sicily. He immigrates to meet up with his brother, who was a painter in Philadelphia. And then, you know, gets this whole, his whole family and all the cousins and family, you know, that were really close on that, particularly on that side of the family. And I never meet him. I never hear about him making wine. I only hear about my grandfather making a little bit of wine like every other, but not making wine back in Sicily, not building his own barrels and everything. And so just recently, and there's a picture up on my Instagram probably from 6 months ago, I was in Philadelphia in September and when I saw you, and they had cleaned out my grandfather's house and they found this old Cooper Chammer from Sicily. And so I took that back to New Zealand with me. I've got a really cool photo, and people are like, you're going to use it to fix your barrel? I'm like, no, man, I don't want to break that thing, you know? So it's just kind of, I have it on my desk now, and I hold it when I, you know, really contemplating about my next moves.
There you go.
Meditating
and being mindful, hold on to that, and it'll come to you.
Absolutely. So, I kind of, you know, I say like wine and you know, sense memory is like time travel. You know, everybody talks about, and music is that way too, where they're probably the only two things that I really know of that are sort of not tangible, you know, that you can smell something or hear something and be, you know, teleported back to your grandmother's kitchen or your first kiss or whatever it is. So that, there's a really cool connection there. But then there's this other connection where I'm like, there's something in me, I guess, that I went down this route. I mean, nobody in Philadelphia, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania in my family are like even nearly close to into wine. I mean, now they kind of drug them along, you know.
Right.
But it's completely independent, you know. And the family restaurant is way more of a beer bar than it, you know. It's all in the microbrews, and they have a cool little wine list, but it's not something that's like. I just feel this connection with Michelin because somehow, you know, both did this. And when I first made wine, the first year in New Zealand, it was, you know, and then again, this is before I knew about Michelin. It was the weirdest feeling because I was like, I don't know where I'll be the rest of my life, but I know I'll make wine every year for the rest of my life. Like one way or another, I'll have some kind of ferment going. And even if it's a little tiny bit just for me, I know I'll do this for, you know, and after all that travel and time and, you know, that it was like, well, at least I know I'm going to do this.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool that you didn't know the connection and it's there.
So weird. Yeah.
For those who believe in like supernatural stuff and, you know, it's.
I don't know. I don't know. I think it could honestly. I think we don't, you know. I think it's more. It could, you know, I'm not saying exactly in my case, but I think stuff like that could be more scientific than we actually give it credit for. You know, the word instinct.
Right.
Is thrown around like just a broad term, and it's like you're using this word instinct for a salmon that's going to swim all the way back upstream to lay eggs. Like, how does it know to do that, you know?
Right.
How do these birds know to fly south, you know? Because it's in their DNA and because it's built into their DNA, and it's passed down through every lineage. If, you know, I fight the birds off at my house all the time. You know, if they nest there, they're going to know to come back if they were born there to nest again. And so what is that? You know, that's instinct. Well, we don't know exactly, you know, there's some sort of DNA chain in there that's causing that. And I like to think that there's some sort of DNA chain from Michelin into me that, for whatever reason, twisted again and made, you know, wanted me to do this. You know?
I think that's awesome. I think it's totally cool. Okay, so I would love to hear about Gimlet Gravels.
Oh, yeah.
That is very unique to your wine growing region, and it's kind of cool. So can you explain what that is? And you have a Malbec that you've titled with that. So what is Gimlet, Gravels, and how does it impact your Malbec?
Well, it's a really cool story, and I think that's why I think it's on a lot of like the Series 4 WSET stuff, because first of all, I joke around, nothing like having alliteration. You know, they've done a great job marketing and branding it, and I've come to understand it more now that I'm part of the association. I've made some wines from it before, but only joined the association I think after 2014, and it really is about this trademark that they have on putting Gimlet Gravels on your bottles, on your tasting notes, on your website, whatever it is, on your marketing materials. And it's because it's the only actual soil appellation that I know of in the world where it's literally defined by exactly where this river went. So not political boundaries or there's a mountain over here, so it just is everything from northeast, whatever it is. It's literally, there was a river there in 1862, and then there was an earthquake and a flood, and it took a shorter path to the ocean, and it just left all rocks behind. So you can go online to their website, which I think is gibletgravels.co.nz, and you can see the photos, and, you know, it's just all rocks. It's almost like hydroponic wine growing, but there is about 7 meters deep still a river underground there, and we have a lot of aquifers. You know, I live on the Appalachian next to it called the Bridgepot Triangle, and that same river, you know, is my drinking water at our house, or our drinking water. But I think because of its definition and what it quickly became known as a premium wine region and the story behind it, I mean, it was a tip. It was a drag strip because it was so flat, and they were going to quarry. There was already a quarry. There's still a quarry there, but they were going to quarry the whole region, and these three viticulturists, mostly Alan Limmer from the old Stonecroft Vineyard, fought the council. And Alan's just this, he's a doctor, I think he's a chemist, and he's just one of these guys who's just relentless. He just, no, we're going to, you know, you guys don't know what you're missing. And he kind of got a couple other guys with him, and they fought the council for 10 years in litigation. And now, you know, it's the most expensive land in the country for vines. It's all, and nobody puts their winery on it anymore. Like, there's a couple little small ones, but, you know, Villa Maria and, you know, even Oyster Bay, a couple of the big guys have vineyards there, but nobody puts, because of the land, you don't want to waste it by putting a winery there, you know? So, and it's small enough where that, you know, you can, you know, sort of surround it with what you need, but it's just all vines. And you really can go up and you can see the different leaf colors when you're up above on the hill and see, you know, how different it is there. And because the vines struggle a little bit, the canopy structure is a little more open, and so that you get that really strong UV and sunlight in there, and it creates for, you know, I think edgier wines, of course, stonier, bonier wines. And with the Decibel Gibel Gravels Malbec, I purposely use no new oak, and I use a lot of large format barrels because I wanted to show that, and it's and I hadn't always done that, but I've kind of come to that and from about 2016 onwards, probably, trying to use as much large format as I can because I want the wine to just be edgier, bonier, stonier. I always go to do like finding trials, and I go, no, just leave it the way it is. Let's keep it, you know, let's show that wet stone on the nose. Let's show that edgy, bony, rocky tannin on the palate. And that's another reason. Going back to Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, why entry-level people love Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs because they can identify it and people like what they know. Well, you put that in front of a, you know, level 4 WSET in a blind tasting, and they've tasted Gibel Gravels before. They'll go, I know that nose. You know, I know that palate. That's New World. It's got a bony, you know, it's got a certain aromatics. It's got to be Gibel Gravels, you know. And of course, when it's Syrah and Cabernet Merlot blends and stuff like that, there's, and yet, you know, you're not smelling gum trees, so it's not Australia, so or eucalypts or whatever. So yeah, it's like a, and so they've had a great success. You know, the high quality wines, high quality producers in there, that's helped a lot, obviously. But they've also done a really good job with that sort of trademarked soil, if you will, and marketing that around the world. So they've done these great tastings in Hong Kong versus Bordeaux, and they've done it in London and San Francisco, and it's helped. And but it's only like tip of the iceberg trying to get some of these wines into the U.S. You know, the Malbec's like a weird thing. I think I'm the only one doing 100% Malbec imported into the U.S. Let alone from the Giblet Gravels. Most of the Giblet Gravels wines are, you know, Cabernet, Merlot, Cab Franc, blends or Syrah. And there's some, you know, Cabernet, I think, from there is really special. Real long growing season, a little more Bordeaux-esque, but still New World. And then the Syrahs, though, are very, very, like, our own. The more we make the Syrahs, the more they just seem like they're Hawke's Bay Syrahs. So, yeah, it's cool. Cool little wine region.
So how difficult was it for you to get grapes from there?
Again, strategically, Malbec. So there's a lot of it around, and yeah, there's a couple big producers that I bought from originally, and you'd be amazed at how and why. It just has to do with like corporate and changing labels, and yeah, okay, sell him some Malbec. And now I work with an organic vineyard that I've been working with since 2014. Originally, I had Malbec from the Bridge Pas, which is what I make the Nouveau out of now. But, yeah, it's always a challenge, always a game. So I'm always up for negotiating and, you know, trying to plead my case for the guy who just wants to make, you know, a bit of Malbec on the side, you know.
There you go. Yeah, it's I've had a couple of wines. You said Villa Maria makes one, right, or a couple from?
I really like Villa Maria as a, you know, they're, I think, the third biggest producer in the country, but I love them. They're a champion for organics. A lot of single vineyard wines. They champion a lot of different varietals and regions. They're big pushers of Hawke's Bay, so I can't say enough good things about a big company as I can about Villa Maria.
Yeah, I think they're the first ones that I had that I was introduced to Gimlet Gravels. That's
yeah.
The and I've seen it a couple of different places, but it's not so common that I can see it on a label here.
You'll see their Sauvignon Blanc around, but you know that's from Marlboro, you know.
Right.
But even their like entry level stuff, I think is just good wine. Like there's nothing wrong, you know. It's well made. You know, I worked for a couple of their wineries back in the day, and they're a good outfit, you know.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to taste their wines on several occasions, and I've never been disappointed. And now I might be confusing, but didn't they just have a sparkling too? Didn't they?
They probably do, but they have a partnership with Domaine St. Michel, and so they have a distribution partnership with them, I think. So,
okay.
They might. I know they do some bubbles, but I don't know that it comes into the U.S. But the other Giblet Gravels wines you can find in the U.S., Craggy Range, who are their premium Hawke's Bay producer. They do great Giblet Gravel stuff. Trinity Hill you'll see around, and sort of spits and spatters of other stuff. You know, if you tasted an Oyster Bay Merlot, they don't put Giblet Gravels on it. They're not a part of the association, but a lot of that fruit is from the Giblet Gravels. Unfortunately, it's a bit like Coca-Cola, you know, it tastes the same every year. But they're just a big, you know, corporate winery. You might start to see some more of the Villa Maria brands like Tiawa and Esk Valley. Esk Valley is in the U.S. I think they're in the Midwest. It's pretty good. They make some Giblet Gravel stuff. I used to bring in Unison wines back in the day. They're really good wines. Sacred Hill, they've been around. And people like that. So you can find them around. Craggy Range, you'll see in a lot of wine lists. And give those guys, they make great wines.
That's how many acres, not specific, because I don't expect anybody to actually know those. How many acres do you think are within the Gimlet Gravels area? Is it large?
No, it's not very large. It's I want to say it's like 600 hectares or something. It's not. No, I'm going to actually look it up because it's not. That's the other thing is it's been pretty defined and it's not very big, so that helps. It's sort of much like the rest of New Zealand, it punches way above its weight, you know.
Right. Very cool. Very cool. Well, are you ready to play my little game of opposites?
I could try. Okay. Hope I don't get myself in trouble.
No. Super simple. I'm just going to give you two terms that are opposites of each other, and whichever one resonates with you more, you just answer. So there is no right or wrong answer. And
okay. As long as you're coming up with the terms, and I don't say something horrendous. You know,
I'm giving you the terms. You're going to choose one or the other. Okay, so we're going to start off with some non-wine terms, and then we'll get into some wine terms. Okay, night or day?
Night.
Sunset or sunrise?
Sunset.
Black or white?
White.
Walk or run?
Walk. I can't run anymore. Bad knees.
Food or drink?
Oh, man. My email address is wine is food, so I'm going to say food because that might encompass wine as well. You know?
There you go. Old world or new world?
That's a tough one. I'm going to say new world.
Sweet or dry?
Dry.
Bubbles or still?
Always go bubbles. You know, you never have enough champagne, you know.
I agree with that. Oak or stainless?
I'll go classic oak, you know. You get a lot of variability with oak, you know. Especially after just being in Italy and seeing all those giant oak casks. I was so jealous, you know.
Oh. Drink now or drink later?
Drink now.
Blend or varietal?
That's a tough one. I think blend, you know, when you can, you know. Is that a term I just came up with? A phrase? Blend when you can.
Vintage or non-vintage?
Vintage. Absolutely vintage, yeah.
Cork or screw cap?
Professionally or personally?
That's a good segue. Which is which? Professionally?
Well, unfortunately in New Zealand, we've had a horrendous history of getting bad corks sent to us from the other side of the world. It was a very easy decision. And again, wineries like Villa Maria led the way with this. To go 100, you know, I think we're something like 90% screw cap now. And it suited our style of wines of being, you know, fresher styles of wine. And I get it. I had an awesome white blend that I absolutely loved in 2014. I worked so hard on that wine. And I had like, I don't even know, 45, 50% cork failure in one way or another with it. Some of them were TCA. Some of them were just slightly oxidated, which is actually the worst because people just thought the wine was that wine.
Yeah.
And some were really oxidative. And luckily I had my brother at the family restaurant who would, you know, I eventually pulled him off the market and he kind of ran them all through his restaurant with our distributor there. And he must have dumped 100 bottles or something. Oh. It was crazy. It was gut-wrenching because after that, I was like, what am I doing? I got to go, you know, particularly at the price point I am and everything. I work for a winery called Paratua and still help them out in the U.S. In fact, I'll be selling their wines tomorrow. You know, they have a $50 range wine and they have a $120 range wine. They can afford in that margin to spend $1.50 on a cork per wine, which, and you know, they might get one with a hint of TCA out of every 300 bottles or something, you know, but you really got to pay for cork to get certainly where we are. Otherwise you go for composite cork, and I just say go screw cap then, you know. It's, I'm not a, you know, I know there's some decent Diam cork out there, but I haven't liked the way the wine's performed under Diam. So, screw cap. But personally, right. Of course, you know, romantic cork, pop open a bottle of wine, you know.
Right. All right, Napa or Sonoma?
Well, I worked in Napa, so I'll say Napa. Napa's fun.
Commercial or indigenous?
Indigenous, yeah. Most of the stuff I'm doing is indigenous these days, or at least some form of it, yeah. Mostly indigenous, yeah.
Cool. Bordeaux or Rhone?
Rhone. Definitely a Rhone boy. No doubt about it. I won't turn down a nice bottle of Bordeaux, but, I'm way more into the, you know, Grenache, Syrah, type of stuff these days, and have been on a good run of that for 8-9 years now, you know.
Yeah, I think I'm probably more Bordeaux, Cap Franc, so Bordeaux, but sure. I won't turn down a Rhone.
I mean, if I had to pick, you know, and that's, you know, but then again, you know, the problem is for a long time, Bordeaux, there was to get a really good one, the pricing was really high, and it still kind of is that way. And yes. Now the pricing's starting to get into, certainly it's gone through Burgundy, and now it's going up into Rhone as well. So, yeah, get them while you can. But right. Rhone varietals, I'm a big fan of, you know.
And my last one, I already know what your answer is. Warm climate or cool climate?
Cool climate, yeah.
Cool climate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining me and taking time out of your hectic travel time.
Well, I just saw what time it was. Yeah, we killed some time.
And, you know, I guess I'm lucky that you come to the United States so frequently, because what time is it in New Zealand right now?
Right now it is probably, what, 2:50 p.m. tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So thank you for taking time from your busy schedule to talk with me. And for people to be able to find you, where can they find you on the socials and what your website and anything else you want to tell us?
Yeah, decibelwines.com, DecibelDan on Twitter, DecibelWines on Instagram, DecibelWines on Facebook. We're on all those. I'm on LinkedIn and all that stuff as well, Daniel Brennan. And, yeah, just look for Decibel Wines. You'll find me. That's pretty best way to start.
Can they place orders on your website?
Yeah, we ship to the U.S. direct, though you have to order 12 or 15 bottles to do the shipping. I think the shipping's included in the price. So, and then, of course, yeah, New Zealand, Australia as well, and Instagram. That's a good spot to follow. So we're always putting cool stuff up there.
And on your website, is there a page on your website that tells them where they can find you in stores here?
That's a moving target. I've tried to do that in the past and always just seem to fall behind. So what we do list there is all our distributors, so that if they go into a shop and they don't find it, they can say, hey, well, it says he's in, you know, Illinois is brand new for us, so it's not up there yet. But he's in Illinois. He's with J.L. Glunz, who's an old school distributor, you know. So
yes,
that's a new one.
Paso.
Yeah. So they're, what's that, Paso? What's that?
Yeah, the Glunz family has a winery from Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
A winery,
yep.
In Paso. They just won best of show in for their port in the San Francisco Chronicle.
Yeah, they seem to be a good outfit with, and I'm certainly organized. They got me organized the next 3 days. So, yeah, we'll have that up, that type of stuff on the website. Our importer does a fantastic job of getting us out into a lot of different places now. So, yeah, it's exciting. And then, of course, I'm always, you know, you can always just ask me.
There you go.
Find
Hit
me
him up on
that.
Instagram. Hit him up
That's
on
right.
Instagram.
Slide into those DMs, you know.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you very much. I hope you are either going to relax the rest of the night or, I don't know, go find a nice bottle of wine. I'm sure.
I'm going to find some dinner, I think, but yeah, not going to be a late one.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much. Enjoy. Best of luck in selling your, you know, doing what you're doing in Chicago and Michigan and everywhere else you're traveling before heading home, and safe travels.
Thanks, Lori.
I have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, slàinte.